Hi, I'm Alyssa Milano, and this is Sorry Not Sorry.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
In their frenzy to completely control women, the Republican Party is attacking every aspect of our reproductive health. This includes not only access to abortion care and birth control, but also is having some serious and chilling effects on access to in vitro fertilization. Amanda Zurowski knows this all too well, and she joins us today to discuss.
I wanted to address my senators, Cruz and Cornyn, who neither of whom regrettably are in the room right now, but I would like for them to know that what happened to me, I think most people in this room would agree, was horrific.
A decision from the Alabama Supreme Court has alarmed doctors, patients, and reproductive rights advocates. On Friday, the court ruled that frozen embryos created through in vitro fertilization, or IVF, are legally children and thus protected.
That was Alabama State Representative Ernie Yarbrough, a Republican, yesterday debating new legislation to protect in vitro fertilization while quoting both the Bible and Vanilla Ice. If it wasn't already clear, it's sort of a mess down in Alabama.
So tonight, let's stand up for families like hers. To my friends across the aisle, don't keep this waiting any longer. Guarantee the right to AVF.
Hi, my name is Amanda Zurowski, and I am fighting for reproductive rights. Sorry, not sorry.
Amanda, welcome back to Sorry Not Sorry. I really appreciate you being here with us again. Will you just tell our listeners, remind them a little bit about who you are and the work you do?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me back. I'm very excited to be here with you all. So I guess the reason why I'm here mostly is because I'm the lead plaintiff in the Texas lawsuit that's challenging our state and our attorney general over their abortion bans. And we are the first lawsuit in a post-Roe world that is comprised of patient plaintiffs who are taking action against the state for their abortion bans.
Bless you. You're doing such incredible work. And, you know, Texas, I don't even know where to begin. Obviously, passed one of the most restrictive anti-abortion laws in the country, a law that nearly cost you your life in 2022. Will you fill everyone in on what happened to you if they're not familiar with the story?
So long story short, I was diagnosed with a condition called cervical insufficiency, or incompetent cervix, equally as terribly named. Essentially what it means is I was going into early labor and I was only 18 weeks along, so there's absolutely no way the baby was going to survive. Now, bear in mind, this was a baby that we worked a year and a half to create. We desperately wanted her. And so the news that we were going to lose her was devastating enough. But then on top of that, the trigger ban had just gone into effect. And so my doctor said, because the baby's heart is still beating, we can't provide an abortion because that's now illegal. I just had to wait until I met the legal exception in Texas, which meant that my life was at risk. So even though my doctors could have intervened right away, in a pre-Roe world, they couldn't anymore because it would be considered an abortion. And so I had to wait until the baby's heart stopped or I almost died.
Like, I literally, my face right now, I wish my listeners could see my face, because it's like a combo of shock, disgust. I'm so fed up with all of it. And I know you are too.
And speaking of shock, actually, that's what happened to me. That's the end of this part of the story. Is I went into septic shock after 3 days of waiting due to the infection because I couldn't get an abortion. And so I was in the hospital for a week. And now my fertility is forever compromised. Long-lasting physical, mental, psychological, emotional trauma. And this is, you know, still going on every single day because these bans are still in place. And that's why we're fighting.
Part of what we want to talk about is apparently, especially across the South, but not only in the South. And I think that's the thing. People think of this as a Southern problem. We look at Idaho and Ohio and even attempts in places where, luckily, I don't think it'll happen, Michigan, Wisconsin. This is not just a Southern problem, but across the country, lawmakers saw what happened to you. And I hate saying what happened to you because it was done to you, right? This was a more active thing. But what you went through and decided they wanted more of that in their states. And we seem to be this contest with GOP-led legislatures over who can pass the most dangerous law. And I just wonder, after what you went through, what that sort of feels like as a woman when you see your government trying to do this to you and other women.
Well, it tells me that they don't care about us and their agenda is more important than the lives that they are elected to protect. And it's callous, it's cruel, but I think it's also really terrifying to think about the fact that right now this is at a state level and there are still some places where abortion is protected. But if Trump is elected, he's already said that he'll impose a national abortion ban. And this is going to be everybody's reality, regardless of what state you live in. And that's terrifying.
I mean, this is what they've been working up towards for the last 50 years, right? They've been waiting for this moment. They've been putting all the pieces in place with the Supreme Court. This was a very specific agenda that is now coming into fruition.
Yep. This was a 50-year perfectly orchestrated attack.
I do want to say that the fact that Biden had to sign an executive order investing in women's health is, I think, part of the problem, right?
As Jill just talked about, we've launched the first ever White House initiative in women's health research to pioneer the next generation of scientific research and discovery in women's health. Think of all the breakthroughs we've made in medicine across the board, but women have not been the focus. Research has been taking much too long to get to y'all. I've called on Congress, as we've said, I'm repeating myself here, $12 billion for that effort. And today we're jump-starting that investment by dedicating $200 million to the National Institute of Health to tackle some of the most pressing health problems facing women today. With the executive order I'm about to sign, I'm directing the most comprehensive set of executive actions ever taken to improve women's health, ever taken. And I'm going to ensure that women's health is integrated and prioritized across the entire federal government. It's not just in women's health, not just at NIH, the National Science Foundation, the Defense Department, the Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, across the board, this is really serious.
Like, that we need the president, because it's not just intuitive, that we need an executive order to invest in research, particularly issues in menopause and women's health. We need an executive order. It's not just cardiovascular disease, autoimmune diseases, all these things that impact women more than men at a higher rate than men. And the president has to sign an executive order because those things just aren't in place already.
It's interesting you bring that up. I was actually there at the White House when the president signed that executive order. There was a reception celebrating Women's History Month. And then that was the culminating piece at the end of the reception, which was so cool to see history literally being made in front of my eyes. It was really incredible. And I was so proud and hopeful that we have a president right now who is willing to make this investment. But Maria Shriver was there and she was talking about all of the work that she's been doing because she's really a leader on this front and in women's healthcare. And she was talking about one study in particular that was done to track the effects of low estrogen on, I think it was heart attacks or strokes, which is an issue that disproportionately affects women. And in the study, not a single woman was included. And that was just the norm for healthcare for so long. Why has it taken us so long to recognize women as equal citizens.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
We're still not recognized in the Constitution. This is my tombstone issue, is getting the ERA passed. Specifically, just in healthcare alone, it's honestly, and I just woke up in a mood today, so go with me on this. I think I was wrong about this country. I think that I always believed that the intention was to continue to make it everything that it had the potential to be. But when you're looking at the people in power and how they bear hug their power at the expense of everyone else, I'm so sad. I'm sad that my mom needs hearing aids and they're not totally covered. I have to spend $4,500 on hearing aids for my mom. That should be just a given. If someone's getting older, you know what? The government should pay for hearing aids.
Well, we can't do that. We're cutting Social Security, right? Like, why would we pay for hearing aids when we're not going to pay for a place to live or food?
Yeah, or tampons or anything like that.
Not only that, but we're just going to tax tampons higher than anything because they're for women.
Can you imagine if they made tampons for men, that it would be like 17 cents and they'd be in a cigar tube, right?
No, they'd just be giving them out.
You just have a subscription. You just get them for free every month. No problem.
Medically, we would have cured menstruation, right? It wouldn't even happen anymore, right? It would be long gone.
Definitely not menopause. Okay, as a result of your experience in Texas, doctors advised you not to try to carry another child, which must have been devastating. Tell us how that impacted you and your husband.
Yeah, that was a tough pill to swallow, but our journey has been long and winding, so this is going to sound bleak, and I don't mean it to. It's just the reality of infertility. We have gotten pretty accustomed to receiving bad news. And so when we receive bad news like that, we don't think that you should carry another child. It doesn't immediately feel bad anymore. It feels like, okay, we're going to go down a different route now. And so we are pursuing surrogacy, and we are so thankful that IVF exists, because I had to do IVF in order to get the eggs so we could create embryos. I'm so thankful that surrogacy is a thing. I'm so thankful that my husband and I have the means to pursue these things, because it can be cost prohibitive for probably most families. And so we're very fortunate and we recognize that. But again, we're a little scared because look at what happened in Alabama and look what happened to IVF. And who knows that they're not going to come after surrogacy next. And so even though we're hopeful, there's a lot of fear and anxiety still going on.
Even behind a white picket fence is a story to be told.
Hello.
Allison Spagnolo has spent the last 4 years raising her family here in Texas.
You can't beat the weather down here.
But since Roe v. Wade was overturned, she feels like there is a storm that could loom over the state.
So I have been pregnant actually 7 times. I have 2 kids.
Her youngest arrived after multiple in vitro fertilization attempts, but creating this beautiful family took 5 miscarriages. 2 had to be aborted because they were not viable.
And I was so lucky that I was able to get it.
And while Texas law allows an abortion to save the life of the mother, she worries about laws tightening, as well as the future of her frozen embryo.
We don't know what we're going to be made to do with it.
I think a lot of our listeners might not know what the IVF process is. You know, you hear it as sort of a medical term, and people may understand that it has to do with pregnancy. but I don't think people sort of understand what the actual experience is like. Would you share that a little bit about what your experience was?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for asking. That's a good call out, because when you've been in the IVF world, you're so in it, you forget that other people don't get it, because it is a wild thing. So essentially, I'll try to distill it as much as I can. Essentially, what doctors are doing is they are stimulating your follicles to grow as many eggs as possible. They then go in and surgically harvest the eggs. Those eggs are then fertilized sometimes that very same day. Sometimes the eggs are frozen by themselves, depending on the family situation. Because I have a partner and we're ready to get moving right away, ours were fertilized right away. And that creates a blastocyst, which over the course of a couple days will eventually become an embryo. Each day in that process, you're getting updates on like how many eggs were fertilized, how many made it to the next day, how many made it to the next stage. And so the number gets smaller and smaller, which is how it is supposed to work, right? That's very normal. But eventually, you hopefully end up with a number of embryos. They typically are genetically tested for chromosomal abnormalities, and then you're left with your final result of how many normal implantable embryos you have. And then they just sit on ice until you're ready to use them, typically. There's a different path that we could talk about, but that's getting into the weeds. You've got these frozen embryos. Then what happens is your doctor will put you through a cycle to get you ready to implant the embryos so that you hopefully then are pregnant. In my case, I can't go through that cycle myself to get pregnant. So we will use a surrogate who will go through a very similar cycle, and then our embryo will be implanted into her.
Were there barriers to you accessing IVF services? For example, did insurance cover everything? Did you need any special testing or medication that was not covered that you didn't have access to?
It wasn't an access issue. Again, my husband are very fortunate with our health insurance and where we live, but I had a number of physical issues because of the infection that was caused by the sepsis. So my uterus was completely scarred over. Both of my fallopian tubes were completely scarred over. My doctor had to go in and clear all of that out. He got most of it out, but one of my tubes remains permanently closed. My uterus had also entirely collapsed, so he had to go in and surgically rebuild my uterus. There was several months delay just because of the harm that had been done to me and getting my body back to as close to normal as possible. The IVF process, you'll hear stories of women who go through multiple rounds, multiple cycles. It took me 3 cycles before we had any viable embryos. Insurance pays for some of it, definitely not all of it. It is extraordinarily expensive. The medication piece can also be tricky. You have to, what I have learned, really be your own advocate, and you have to really be on top of your own medications, timings, appointments, because it is a lot. And even though your team is doing their best, you've got to advocate for yourself.
Okay, cut to Alabama. Passed a law to out Texas, Texas, which is hard to do. It's hard to out Texas, but Alabama did it. And one of the effects was that IVF clinics temporarily stopped providing services. Can you tell us about that law?
Yeah, that news shattered me. I was terrified of the ruling of the embryo personhood, because that brings into the front a billion questions, right? Just insane questions that if you haven't been through IVF, you wouldn't even think of. But here's just a list of some that went through my mind. Okay, if my embryos are people, can I write them off on my taxes this year? We are transferring them out of Texas somewhere that we feel they're safer. Is that human trafficking? If my surrogate gets pregnant with an embryo and miscarries, is that wrongful death? These are just insane things that now we're left questioning. That's why we immediately wanted to move our embryos out of Texas, because to your point, if Alabama can out Texas, you know Texas is probably in short order going to try to do the same thing. And so we were terrified that we wouldn't be able to get them out in time. So there's that piece. But then the temporary halt of IVF services, I understand why clinics did that, because there was so much up in the air that they're like, we don't know what we can even do anymore. So of course, we're going to wait until we have clarification. That makes sense. But I was just thinking of all of the patients who now their cycles are delayed, or they're canceled, or their transfer is canceled. And the timing in IVF is so critical. It is literally to the hour that you have to administer certain drugs, or you have to do transfers. It is that sensitive. And so when they were without IVF services for, I think the final count was, what, 10 days? That is dream crushing. That is soul crushing. My heart was just so broken for all of those families.
Yeah, I will say that was where my mind first went. And where your mind went was is just absolutely terrifying. And I think a real thing that lawmakers have not even started to think about, which is part of the problem here, is that people are passing laws without thinking about the consequences, just trying to get their, like, quote unquote, moral victory by doing this thing. And the consequences are pretty far ranging. And we saw that in Alabama, because they pretty quickly turned around and passed a law saying, oh, we didn't mean those embryos, right? There's something different here.
Doctors at one of the three major clinics that paused treatment say they now have enough legal cover to resume IVF today.
We've kept our lab fully operational so that we'd be positioned to resume care as soon as possible.
But the law does not answer the central and divisive question in the state Supreme Court ruling, classifying frozen embryos as people.
This is a quick resuming the services fairly quickly, but it does not address the long-term problem.
I guess the question is, do you trust them? Do you think that they actually didn't mean that? Do you feel like IVF is actually going to be targeted?
I don't know what their intent was. I find the whole case to be very interesting because it all stemmed from, my understanding was, patients whose embryo had accidentally been destroyed. And so they sued for wrongful death. I'm pretty sure that if you're going through IVF, that you wouldn't then sue in a case that could take away access to IVF. So I think it might have backfired there. As far as the people who made the ruling, I'm not sure what their intent was, but I do feel slightly encouraged by the backlash and how far back they're trying to now walk their ruling and the implications and everything that followed. I am actually a little bit hopeful about that because I think they saw, like, oh, we messed up. This is a problem. We can't harm or control IVF. But then on the other hand, my own governor was asked in an interview while all of this was going on whether Texans should fear access to IVF going away. And he couldn't answer. He couldn't just say, no, they have no reason to be fearful.
Part of the, it's weird because this part of the conversation just went away. There was a very distinct moment where IVF and abortion went together because of the family planning aspect of it. Meaning if you were going to implant 4 embryos with the hopes of 1 taking and 2 take, but you only want 1, then you're aborting 1. In their view, you're aborting 1 embryo. And so that was classified as abortion. And so I think that's where the whole connection comes from, which just shows you how little they know about anything.
And speaking about those connections, too, in Texas, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals recently just issued a ruling limiting birth control for teenagers that people under 18 have to have their parents' consent now. Not for condoms, right? Not condoms, but for birth control pills. And it seems like Texas is the epicenter of this. But it's almost like they're trying to set an example. Abbott doesn't want to say, oh, you can't worry about this, because I think he just wants to see how far he can go. Like, where is the limit and what is the end game for him? It really sickens me.
Yeah. And, you know, in that same interview, Abbott was talking about how this is a difficult topic. This is really complicated because if you've got these embryos and you don't use them, I mean, who knows what happens to them and what happens if the couple splits up or what happens if the mother gets sick or the mother dies. And I'm listening to him talk. And I'm just getting madder and madder because if you've ever been through IVF, if you have embryos, you have mapped all of that out contractually. So you know exactly what happens in each situation. But he obviously has no idea that's something that you do because he's never been through IVF. So why is he the one telling me whether or not I can have access to IVF? He has no business talking about this.
And despite the GOP scrambling to claim publicly that they support IVF, the Republican study group's proposed budget, signed on to, I think, by most Republicans in the House, supports the Life Begins at Conception Act, which would ban not only abortions, but effectively completely ban IVF. What do we need to do to stop them?
We have a very big election coming up in November. And I think that's the number one, I'm hoping it's going to be the number one issue that people will vote on. Because, yes, of course, this country has tons of issues and there are lots of things to vote on and to think about. But in my mind, there is nothing more crucial than this fight for reproductive rights. And I hope that's how people will vote in November.
I think, you know, we're seeing that too. We've seen that in every potential possible way through the elections that have happened since Roe fell. Reproductive rights are winning elections, and we're recording this on March 27th. And yesterday in Alabama, we saw an Alabama legislature House seat flip from Republican to Democrat because the candidate there made her platform entirely about reproductive rights and reproductive justice. And, you know, I think that this is the strategy that might save us in November, because things otherwise look pretty grim. It's sad that it's literally women having to fight for their lives, right? That actually fighting for lives in order to win this election. It's an existential threat. And it seems like we have so many of those all of the time right now, right? But this one is really particular. And man, I just hope that it gets us there.
I hope people recognize that this fight is also about families. Look at my family that I'm trying desperately to build. And on the one hand, these lawmakers are imposing bans that nearly killed me. And on the other hand, these lawmakers are telling me when and how and if I can create a family using IVF. And it's all about control. And I hope people recognize when they vote, this is about family. And nothing about what these GOP extremists is doing is pro-family, is pro-life. It's just not.
There may be as many as 1.5 million embryos right now frozen in the United States. And most families, like you said, have multiple embryos because of the process, right? What happens if those embryos are suddenly treated as though they're fully formed, born humans?
I wonder about that too. And, you know, in my scenario, is there going to be a situation where, because they're technically children, that I have to implant them to give them a chance to live? What if I can't afford a surrogate? Or what if surrogates become illegal? Are they going to implant them in me? Do I have to attempt to carry them knowing that I can't, and knowing that last time I carried a child, I almost died? What that tells me, if that hypothetical situation ever came true, what that would send a message to me is saying that embryo has more rights and has a higher priority than my own life.
Today, a federal judge heard arguments on whether Arizona's fetal personhood law should be allowed to stand in the wake of Roe v. Wade being overturned. The law, signed by the state's Republican governor last year, confers all the same rights as people who have already been born onto fetuses, embryos, and even fertilized eggs.
All under the guise of pro-life. Right? Tell us what the term pro-life means to you and what a truly pro-life series of laws would look like.
I think pro-life for me as an individual is being able to access the healthcare that I need when I need it. It's no secret at this point that I think anybody should be able to get an abortion whenever they want and for whatever reason they want. In my case in particular, I needed one to not die or not almost die. And so I think it's as simple as that. I think it's just clarifying medical exceptions, which is what my lawsuit is trying to do. I think it's allowing people to make healthcare decisions based on their own best interests under the guidance of a doctor. And I think it's pretty simple. I think the fewer restrictions we have around it, the better. As far as fertility, again, I don't think the government needs to have its hand in my family planning journey, telling me when and where and how and if I can have a family. They just don't belong in my family planning journey. End of story.
Agreed.
And it's always the small government Republicans, right, who are like, oh, we want small government, except for we want it in every bedroom and in every woman's body, right? But you mentioned your lawsuit. Can you update us on that? Like, how's that going?
Yeah, not a whole lot to update you on. Since we last spoke, we were in front of the Texas Supreme Court. That was in December. Because if you recall, just quick refresh, back in July, we had our initial hearing, which we won. And the state immediately appealed, which was not surprising, but it was disheartening. And it went directly to the Texas Supreme Court. Now, I'll clarify here, It will not go beyond the Texas Supreme Court. So that will be the highest it can go. It won't go to the United States Supreme Court. We argued oral arguments in December, and now we've just been sitting and waiting for 3 months for the Supreme Court to decide whether or not we even have standing, which is mind-blowing in and of itself. But once we do hear from them, which could be any day now, we know it'll be by June because it's in this session, which ends in June. But there are a number of different scenarios that could play out. But essentially, the most likely are that the Supreme Court could say, oh, no, you don't have standing, and the whole case gets thrown out and then it's over. They could kick it back down to the appellate court. So we're just waiting.
I have a question for you. And I think there are moments in people's lives that change them and create someone that they never thought that they would be. Who were you before your ordeal in Texas? And how has it changed you? How are you different today as a result of all of this?
That's a good question, because in some regards, I'm an entirely different person because of what I've been through. But when I think about it, at my core, I am still the same person. I have always been a fighter. I have always stood up for what I believe is right. I have always cared about others and done my best to protect them. What I think has changed is who I was meant to become. Because I think 2 years ago, if you had asked me, I was going to become a stay-at-home mom, living in the suburbs, quiet life, maybe volunteering on the PTA, volunteering in the school, just a nice, easy, peaceful life. Certainly not what I became. I wasn't expecting to become what some people have called me, the face of the reproductive rights battle. That's fine. I'll wear that badge very proudly. But I think I just feel this new sense of purpose and honestly, a little bit of duty. Like, I feel like this is my responsibility now. Like, I started this thing. I got this ball rolling. I'm not going anywhere until things change. And honestly, I see my life taking a completely different trajectory where this is my path now. This is my torch to bear. I don't know what's around the corner, but this is my journey. It's hard, but I'm really grateful for the opportunity.
I thought this the last time that we talked, and it continues to strike me today that you remind me so much of Fred Guttenberg, who we've had on the show several times. I don't know if you know Fred, but he was a Parkland father whose daughter was murdered in that school shooting. And he was one person before that shooting happened. And suddenly he felt, again, this responsibility to be doing something for other people. The thing that he's doing isn't going to directly help him now, but he's doing it for others. And he's fierce and very public and courageous. And I think the two of you approach this in very much the same way. And I think we're lucky to have both of you because of the amount of that work that needs to be done and of its importance. And so I guess the question is, how can people support it? How can people listening help you right now?
Well, first of all, that is very kind of you. I will happily accept the comparison to Frank. That's very nice. I have not met him. I would love to. I feel a kindred spirit in him. As far as helping, you know, I think one of my greatest fears between now and November is that this movement, as we call it, is going to lose steam. I'm optimistic that it won't, just because the right seems to have no shortage of issues to present to us to fight on. But I think just continuing the conversation, listening to stories, sharing stories, keeping this at the forefront of people's minds is critical. Ultimately, I don't know if I can say this on this podcast. I think it's okay. I hope people vote in a way that will support reproductive rights in November. That's definitely helpful. It's paramount. It's not just helpful. It's crucial. And then on an individual level in your own communities, there is no act that is too small that will be helpful, whether it's donating your money or your time to a local abortion provider or to centers like the Center for Reproductive Rights, which is representing us in our lawsuit, ACLU, Planned Parenthood. There are so many organizations that are really working together to fight this. And I just think whatever anyone can do, I think some people get nervous that, like, there's not enough. I don't know how to get involved. Like, just have the conversation. Just start there. Every single action is so important. We have to fight on every single front. And I think it's going to take all of us.
And finally, what gives you hope?
I think the community that I have become a part of. I have seen the strength and the fierceness with which people are fighting, and not just women, men too, and everyone in between. And it's just really beautiful. The uplifting spirit, the community, the love, the support, and the grit is really awesome.
Well, Amanda Zarosky, you give us hope. Thank you for all that you do and for being part of the podcast.
Anytime. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you guys and the work that you do.
You were on the ground in Alabama.
The human impact of this cannot be underscored. The trauma that I talked to when I witnessed women say that they spent years and thousands of dollars preparing for IVF only to get calls from their doctors the day before that their procedures were canceled. People are going to remember that no matter what happens with the legislation. And let's remember, Republicans took a week for this, for them to really coalesce around the idea that they supported IVF.
And like I was in an IVF. They had to check with the groups to see what they could say.
I was in an IVF clinic where one of the doctors told me she was having the hardest conversations of her life. I saw her physically feel relief when Donald Trump said that he was going to come out, but she said it was head spinning to think that politics was the reason why she can now tell her patients that they can have their dreams again, that they won't be crushed.
Ugh, I'm done. I am so done with the abject hate of women and people who can get pregnant from a malignant and hateful government. It is no wonder the GOP has only won the popular vote in a presidential election once in the last 35 years. It's why they cheat, why they gerrymander districts and restrict ballot access. They know with absolute certainty that they would lose any power they had if they had to earn it in a fair fight. It's because of the policies of the GOP that we have maternal mortality rates that are three times higher than those in France, our closest companion in industrialized nations. It is because of the policies of the GOP that gun violence is the leading cause of death for American children and teens. It is because of the GOP and their policies that nearly 40% of trans kids make a suicide attempt. It is because of the GOP and their policies that climate change is ravaging our nation. It is because of the GOP and its policies that we nearly lost our democracy in 2020. And it is because of the GOP and its policies that Amanda and so many like her have suffered so terribly. I'm done. I'm done with the GOP. As a nation, we all need to be done with them. November can't come fast enough.
Sorry Not Sorry is executive produced by Alyssa Milano. That's me. Our producer is Ben Jackson, audio editing and engineering by Maciej Lewandowski, and music by Josh Cook, Alicia Eagle, and Milo Bugliari. Don't forget to rate, review, and spread the word. Sorry, not sorry.